the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and I'm very grateful to Margaret Anderson, Robert Donjacour, Michael McMillan, and Tom McAfee. They're voluntary subscribers. You can do it, too, at peterbcollins.com. In a moment, our interview with Professor Ali Ameda, an expert on Libya. And later in this podcast, your humble host offers news and comment on some issues over the last week or so while I've been away. And we'll wrap it up the end of the podcast with San Francisco's comedian and satirist Will Durst. And the Peter B. Collins Show continues. The conflict in Libya continues as well. We turn to Professor Ali Ameda, spelled A-H-M-I-D-A. He is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of New England and the author of The Making of Modern Libya and Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Pete.
Let me first ask your reaction to the coverage by the print media and the corporate television media to date of the uprising against Muammar Gaddafi in Libya.
Well, the coverage has been positive, and I'm thrilled that we don't talk about terrorism, we don't talk about Islam and Islamophobia and all those kind of and the extremists, Al-Qaeda and other groups. We are talking about human beings who have universal aspirations and talking about citizenship, accountability, democracy, you know, freedom of expression, all those universal values. So I hope the uprising of those young people in Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt will bring some kind of critical and comfortable debate in our own society in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And how do you rate the performance and the response of the Obama administration, starting with the president himself?
Well, I think that president has said the right things in supporting the uprising and also being very firm with regard to the really brutal suppression of civilians and the callous attitude toward the citizens of Libya, except that the administration seems to be a little bit undecided or confused when it comes to what would be the action, the right action in reality. And that's typical of this administration, even in the previous two uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt. I was hoping to see more concrete steps, but also some learning from the mistakes and the failing in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that there's a conflict between the message that the United States sends promoting liberty and democracy and our long-term relationships with authoritarian regimes and dictators, particularly in the Middle East?
This is an excellent question. This is at the heart of the most important debate we should have in the United States. We have really a contradiction between our long, long traditions of supporting dictatorships and absolutist monarchies, especially in the Middle East and Africa. And at the same time, at the expense of our constitution and our citizens' support for human rights, human dignity, democracy, consent. And I find that contradiction is really the most important fight that we could have. And unfortunately, most of our media and our academic community sometimes they go along with this really bizarre advocacy for empire. And the discussion about stability and also the national security is a way of undermining any attempt to address human rights. And at the same time, it's a really a very odd imperial justification for supporting elites at the expense of people. And the tension in our society between empire and democracy is really very, very long and very old. I hope we as citizens will pressure our administration and our statesmen to remember that we are not an empire. We are a constitutional, a federal democracy, and that's what's really the core of the society. And any way of trying to wing it or trying to filter our debate into that is really undermining our constitution.
Professor Ahmed, in your view, does the United States have any strategic interest or any treaty requirements to respond to the situation in Libya?
There is no treaty there, but I think the temptation, the imperial temptation to do something foolish like militarily intervening in Libya is really there, and there are people who will be itching to say, let's go there. Like, you know, there is no lesson learned recently. The only legal way will be through the United Nations, and that's the right way. But at the same time, I was hoping that people have the wisdom to, and the Obama administration, to support the uprising, to provide diplomatic humanitarian aid and food and medicine through a formal, clear mechanism, and also to if they decide to go for no-fly zone resolution, that would be done in a legal way and also in concert with other nations, the Arab League, and other regional powers in the Middle East and Africa, so to be legitimate. And I think there is something good to be done if it's limited and clear, because Gaddafi's regime is now so isolated. It's not done, but so isolated, but there are some African countries, North African countries like Algeria, who provide him with mercenaries. So reigning on the African countries and North African countries will be really important. But I got to tell you, Pete, that I'm shocked and appalled that the Obama administration will ask the Saudi government, one of the most corrupt and absolutist monarchies in the region, a very reactionary regime, is to support the uprising in Libya. This is just mind-boggling.
Well, I certainly understand, and the Saudi officials have said that anyone who demonstrates in Saudi Arabia against their government, I think they use the phrase, if you lift a finger against the government, that finger will be cut off. So they're using very strong authoritarian language with their own people. And I share your concern that to invite them into Libya in some form militarily could be a very serious mistake.
Indeed, Pete. And not only this, I doubt that they will be like that. And also this idea of double standard, that there are some countries you support because they are really against us, and like in Eastern Europe, we supported democratic uprising against the one-party Soviet regimes in Eastern Europe. But in the region, like in the Middle East, for example, using national security and stability, we seem to say no. People should be just we let these societies operate in their own, and we keep quiet and let heads being chopped and democratic groups being suppressed, and human rights abuses continue, and we still say national security. I'm not even sure that these regimes will welcome any democratic genuine change in Libya, or for that matter, Egypt or Tunisia. I think they also try to pressure the United States to stand by the dictatorship of Mubarak in Egypt.
Well, and I believe that both the Saudis and the Israelis were able to persuade the Obama administration to at least short-term support Omar Suleiman, the instant vice president that Mubarak tried to hand off power to. And fortunately, the military leaders in Egypt we feel Suleiman has disappeared. I don't know if he's still a player, but we hear nothing about him, and he doesn't seem to have a role in the interim government there. But the U.S. support for the man who ran the torture operations and to whom we outsourced torture during the Bush administration was extremely problematic to me.
Absolutely, and I would say this is really the key question for us as citizens in a very democratic society. The challenge for us is not to see these uprisings through the filters and lenses of stability, national security, or whether that's really friendly to Israel or not, whether that's really friendly to our multinational corporation or not, or our strategic interests or not. I think we should be true to our own democratic principles and also allow people see these societies and respect their choices, see that from their own choices. And this is really true to the best thing about the American society, which is democratic choices, democratic representation, and also, for heaven's sake, we are not a monarchy nor a military government. We are a federal constitutional republic.
And, Professor, how do you react to the role that Secretary of State Clinton has played? On the one hand, she chastised the leaders in the Middle East, particularly the monarchs and dictators, in a speech, I believe, in Dubai in January. And she has shown remarkable restraint for the hawk that I perceive her to be in terms of the idea of military action, even in a concerted fashion, if it is perceived that the United States is taking the lead in imposing a new a no-fly zone or other military actions against Libya. So I'm curious as to how you would respond to her performance on Middle East policy and in particular Libya in the past 6 weeks or so.
Well, Secretary Clinton has been very, in my opinion, very disappointing in her role, because she seems to be acting like a hawkish foreign policy secretary who picks and chooses what's a good victim and what's really a worthy victim and unworthy victims. What's a case that you could really rationalize it and engage it, and cases that you dismiss it. And I think this idea of selecting and choosing who is really fits a favorite situation, a country that's friendly to the United States government, to support it, even if it's absolutist or a dictatorship, and rein in it if it's really in opposition to our own policies. To me, that's the double standard that hurt our reputation overseas. And people are not dumb outside the United States; they see whether we are really consistent or not. Secretary Clinton, to me, has been wavering and selecting in her tone and her reading of the cases when she was asked in the Gulf or when she was asked in Egypt or in her press release. I find her really not even in concert with the Obama but Obama himself, because he said some really very firm, made some firm statements. But when you listen to her or to Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, you find really conflicting statements.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think there is something odd about that, because this is an administration should have been discussing and having a very, very concrete voice, as you know, to us in the United States and to people who are struggling to against dictatorships.
And, Professor, feel free to disagree, but my view is that Secretary Clinton is far too close to Israel in matching our foreign policy to the direct interests of Israel in the region. And I'm curious if you share the same thought, and if you feel that Israel has too much influence on American policy, particularly at this critical time of change.
Well, I think she is, she's reflecting definitely that kind of old selective mentality when it comes to Israel. I think for the sake of the people of Israel and the state of Israel, tough love is needed now, where you really have to, not to see the region through the Israeli interests is very important, but also to see the aspirations. If Israel is a democratic state, it seems to me that it's natural that we support people's choices without looking down at them, that they are children or they're going to be fanatical or they're going to be traditional. So I think you're absolutely right. She seems to be very selective in her way of thinking. And instead of saying, listen, even critical Israeli voices are having problems with the policy of their own state, why can't we, because we are allies, show some tough love? I think that's what's needed, and she's not doing it.
Mm-hmm. And, Professor, you referenced Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who is going to retire sometime this year. He has been speaking more freely because his history, going back to the 1980s, was to kiss up to power and to say whatever was expedient at the time to advance his own career. Now that he is free of that, he's been speaking. He offered a speech at one of the military academies where he said that any future president who wants to invade in Iraq or Afghanistan should have his head examined. And he has been very cautious in embracing even the no-fly zone as a response to the conflict in Libya.
Well, I think that you're right. I think he is, I think he's showing a lot of realism about overextending, from that perspective, overextending the United States military. At the same time, we have to remember that realists, they don't really think about, ethics as much. To them, is really power relation is what counts. And that's the limit of the realism, a realist school in American strategic thinking. And I think this is a pity, because here, and instead of trying to define an issue based on what's going on in Tunisia and Libya and in Egypt, it becomes really, whether really we have enough troops or not, or we're really it's going to be hurting our interests or not. And I have trouble with that, because that means that you really overlook the moral and the ethical questions.
Well, but if we combine the two thoughts, A, that he is concerned about overextending our military, and that's within the purview of his job,
yeah.
But B, that he is critical of adventurism and
yeah.
is basically, without trying to paint himself as an isolationist, is saying that we can't just jump into these conflicts as the world's policeman.
Absolutely. And in the case of Libya, we have to be really a little bit careful. This is not a country like Egypt and Tunisia. The Libyan people went to one of the most brutal colonization in Africa, with the exception maybe of Algeria and the Congo. 500,000 people in Libya perished in the first half of the 20th century under Italian colonialism, especially Italian fascism. And 60,000% died with hunger and diseases and thrust in the concentration camps that were erected in eastern Libya before even the Holocaust. So we're talking about a society that it's scarred, and still deals with the trauma of that violent colonization. They are very sensitive to any outside intervention. At the same time, I think, and I have been in touch with many of my friends in eastern Libya and members of the provincial council in Benghazi. They said, yes, we are open to concrete ideas about no-fly zone, but we need also diplomatic recognition. We need also humanitarian medicine and food supplies because we are facing a crisis right now.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Professor, if I can ask you to comment on the current situation and the prospects for what happens if Gaddafi is killed or ousted. As we're speaking here on the 10th of March, there are basically two fronts in Zawiya and in Bin Jawad. And the word we're getting is that the rebels are holding their own and repelling the government forces in Bin Jawad, but not doing so well in Zawiya. How do you see this shaping up, given that Gaddafi has been able to marginalize any opposition, prevent the development of any real military forces that could effectively oppose him, and without any outside intervention, can the rebels withstand the assault from those loyal to Gaddafi and, as you referenced earlier, the mercenaries that he has been able to bring in from friendly North African nations?
That's an excellent question, and I don't really have a clear answer. I know that the Gaddafi is morally and in terms of legitimacy is gone, but physically he's still there. That's the key issue. But I think the ragtag army, the lack of training, those courageous people need really to face this regime that refused to let them challenge it in a peaceful way. So the key is probably is through coordinating with the Arab League, coordinating with that institution, maybe providing arms, providing aid through in a formal legal way to them, and allowing them to continue. And I believe that this is a key factor in supplying the uprising and allowing it to continue. I also believe that more people are going to defect, because even loyal people, you know, inside the Libyan army, and most of diplomats, Libyan diplomats, defected because of the violent suppression of the uprising. I believe this is a key to the uprising. Now, that's why in the short run, it's going to be very challenging. But worse than that is any military intervention. That will really will empower and revive a dying regime.
And finally, Professor, I think about Cuba and the way the United States has empowered the Castro brothers by trying to maintain a blockade, isolate them both economically and militarily. It's been a despicable failure. And so I'm concerned that the United States will try to use some of the same tactics in Libya and give Gaddafi a boogeyman, a big brother, an outside enemy with which to rally his people.
That's very true. And I think the Cuba analogy is a good one, except that now Gaddafi, the uprising against Gaddafi is really is so broad that his regime has been challenged so much, more than the Cuban government. Right now, we have a momentum. The momentum is that the Libyan people are finally saying, you know, we tried to reform this regime, we tried to do everything, and now it shut and aborted all the doors in front of us. So I think a key in the short run is to supply aid, recognize the government, and maybe provide arms through the Arab League to allow the resistance and the uprising to continue. I think if the regime does some crazy thing, like using weapons that we are not aware of or something like that, then we have to reconsider that question as it comes. Right now, I'm just very, very unconvinced that knowing the Libyan people, and I studied their history for a quarter of a century, and their really struggle for self-determination and sovereignty, I feel like right now, you know, you try to do too much, and then you make it worse. This is different from other cases where probably the people or a segment of other society will accept direct intervention. Libya is a very, very different case.
Professor, I know your time is limited, so thank you for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add that our listeners should know from your knowledge about the situation in Libya?
Well, I think we need to discover Libyan society and Libyan history. Libya is not just Gaddafi and a lake of oil and the silly idea that there is tribalism everywhere. This is a modern society. Yes, there are a kinship organization in the countryside and rural areas, but it's a small, courageous, proud people who have went through a lot in the 20th century. And I think by reading about them, this, you know, understanding their culture, their writers, their novelists, their poets, their music, their activists, their trade unions, their women, a courageous organization, and the remarkable change in the 20th century for this society that moved from one of the poorest and with literacy rate that 95% to one of the most literate you know, educated society in the whole continent of Africa. I think understanding that society and going beyond Gaddafi and oil and the idea of tribalism will be the best step to connect with Libyan people and understand their aspirations and their ups and downs like any other society, including ours.
We've been talking with Professor Ali Amida, Chair of the Department of Political Science, University of New England. Thank you, Professor.
It's been my pleasure, Pete. Thank you so much.
This podcast is dedicated to the memory of my mother-in-law, Rose Shatter, who passed away on the 1st of March.
As I was walking over the highway, I saw above me and in the skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. And all around me a voice was calling. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, California.
Over the last month, as my mother-in-law declined, I spent 2 weeks in Detroit and connected with a lot of family members. And what they have in common is they are middle-class success stories. Sons and daughters of immigrants who came to the Motor City to work in the auto industry all the way back to the 1920s and 30s. And in the family, people worked at Ford, they worked at Chrysler, and they were able to build up their economic fortunes to launch small businesses. And my in-laws are largely involved in the car wash business, and they all have their own independent car washes. And they are the success of the middle class, of FDR's New Deal. Their children are college educated, moving up. That class mobility is something that was a hallmark of the 20th century in this country. And as I talked with Uncle Charlie, who's 93, who spent 32 years working on the plants at the Ford Motor Company. I almost said assembly line, but Charlie told me his story. He didn't work that much on the line. He worked in the glass shop. He's now 93, and he jokes that about three or four times a year he gets a call from the Human Resources Department at Ford Motor Company to see if he's still alive, and they still have to send his pension check. Charlie is battling cancer right now. and his health care coverage is excellent. That's what he worked for. That was the contract that he had under the United Auto Workers. He put in his 32 years, and I don't think the actuaries at Ford or the UAW expected him to live this long. And when I look at those hardworking people who succeeded under the American capitalist system, they all benefited from organized labor, from the union contracts that guaranteed their pay, that gave them regular raises, and at contract time, they often traded away raises for improvements in their pension or their health care. That whole way of life, that whole version of the American dream is under a deep and carefully orchestrated assault by the wealthiest interests in this country. And while I was in Detroit, I was cut off from the news because of my family obligations, and they have a terrible newspaper there, the Detroit News and Free Press. It's one paper with two editions. But I did my best to keep track of the various attacks, including in Michigan, on the rights of working families, the rights of union members, particularly those who work for state government. And in neighboring Ohio, which is where I grew up, Senate Bill 5 is there to eviscerate the rights of labor. And, of course, the front lines are in Madison, Wisconsin. And as I speak to you on Thursday, the 10th of March, it's less than 24 hours since the Republicans who control the Senate switched tactics and eliminated the budget aspects from the budget repair bill so they could ram through the evisceration of collective bargaining rights for state employees in Wisconsin. And I'm looking at a print story here from the Los Angeles Times that does, in a clinical way, report what happened. What they left out was throughout these thuggish Soviet-style proceedings where the majority Republicans abused their power, there was the Democratic leader of the Wisconsin House who kept saying, this meeting is illegal. This action is illegal. And as he kept shouting that, the Republicans took their roll call vote and rammed through the bill that is now nakedly separated from the fiction that this was about budgets. No, it was about busting unions. It was about expanding corporate and billionaire power in this country. That's what Scott Walker is up to. And while there's some comfort that it's now starkly clear, it's very painful to see, because it's happening. And I'm sure there will be legal challenges in the courts to this one-sided, one-party action to kill unions in Wisconsin. But it eliminates any leverage that the Wisconsin 14, the Democratic senators, state senators from Wisconsin, who had been camping out in nearby Illinois to prevent a quorum so that the budget bill, the budget repair bill, could not be passed. And by, you know, using the rules and eliminating the budget aspects to the budget repair bill, the budget repair becomes a union destruction bill. That's what they passed. There was only one Republican senator who voted against it. And certainly there will be more of these kinds of actions because Republicans have control of both houses and the governorship in many states around the country right now. They're on a tear. And we are in their way. this is going to get really, really ugly. Now, in Michigan, the new governor is a former CEO. And I had one encounter with a relative who came up to me and, knowing I'm from California, said, how could Californians be so stupid to reject a great candidate like Meg Whitman for governor? And I was stunned, and I said, there are a lot of reasons. But the new governor in Michigan has a bill that is sailing through the legislature that allows for the emergency management of towns and cities across Michigan. And understand what's going on, because at the state level, they are cutting the funding, the tax revenues that go to local municipalities. This will inevitably plunge many of them into a kind of fiscal default. And when that happens, this new Republican governor is seeking the power to appoint emergency managers for these municipal governments. And those managers will have the power to nullify any contracts that currently exist with that governing body, including, of course, collective bargaining agreements. So the model from Wisconsin is you create a phony fiscal nightmare, and then you take draconian action because there's a fiscal nightmare. And this is playing out in state after state, where the Republicans will not permit even the consideration of reasonable tax increases to prevent these fiscal emergencies. No, they want these emergencies. They thrive on this, and they see it as a way for a historic realignment to end the New Deal, to collapse the middle class with the lower class, the working poor in this country, and expand the already obscene gap between the wealthy and the poor in this country. I got an email from Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Cleveland yesterday, and he raises a very important point about Wisconsin and these other assaults on working families and unions, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and there are other states, New Jersey. And Kucinich asked the question similar to where's Waldo, and that is, where's Obama? Come on, Mr. President, where are those comfortable shoes you promised to put on and walk the picket lines when union members came under assault? That's the promise Obama made during the campaign. And he's made a few comments about Wisconsin, but they've been very limited, very mealy-mouthed, in my opinion. And they amount more to observations than any kind of a critical call coming from the leader of the United States. And I believe that his silence gives tacit approval to the corporatists, the billionaires, the plutocrats, the Tea Party nutballs, who are making, as I said, an historic realignment of the United States. It's time, it's well past time, for the president to take a firm position in support of the rights of working families and union members. Now, as I speak to you on Thursday, the 10th of March, there's call for a student strike in Wisconsin on Friday the 11th, and they're asking students all across the country to stay home in sympathy and solidarity. If you can do it, I hope you will. And I believe that given the landscape and the very limited leverage the Democrats and their supporters have in Wisconsin and these other states with huge Republican majorities and Republican governors, that it really is time to consider and to organize a general strike in Wisconsin, if not elsewhere. So I hope we'll see that. But this is going to be a long struggle. And once again, the Democrats seem not only to lack the focus and the desire to really fight back, but they're always looking for a way to compromise. You cannot compromise with these terrorist types who are hell-bent on the destruction of many interests in this country, most notably the middle class. Also, I got an email from people who were trying to organize a gas strike saying, don't buy gasoline, here on Thursday, the 10th of March. And I've seen these in the past, and I'm sympathetic. It's a gesture that some people can make. But the oil companies know you're going to have to fill that tank sooner or later. And even if you organize it all against BP or one other retailer of gasoline, they know that they're going to get you. So I don't see that as a very valuable approach, but I have sympathy for the people who are espousing it. Also, I'd like to just point out in very simple terms that we are being hosed, screwed over once again, by the oil companies. Because the speculation that is going on in the crude oil market doesn't have an immediate and direct impact on the price that they need to charge for gasoline at the pump. No, it's pure exploitation. Because the gasoline that you pump today came from crude oil that was processed sometime in the last week or month. That oil doesn't come from Libya. It's not affected by the spot market for crude price. And the oil companies are banking the difference by once again gouging the American public. And, oh, where's the Obama administration on that one? Don't hold your breath. Well, James O'Keefe can claim another victim from his illegal an unethical use of videotape and entrapment. You probably know the story. O'Keefe is the guy who brought down Acorn, who was arrested for breaking into Senator Mary Landrieu's office to try to do something with her telephone system, who was caught trying to con a CNN reporter and maybe get laid at the same time. James O'Keefe is a provocateur from the far right in this country, and his latest victim is National Public Radio. And you've probably seen, because the media is very happy to take these heavily edited setup entrapment videos and just play the juicy parts. So we have the case of the fundraiser, the vice president, Ron Schiller of NPR, who was on his way out anyway, but he agreed to go to lunch with some fake Muslims, a group that was organized and orchestrated by O'Keefe. There was a hidden camera there as they had lunch. And this man, Ron Schiller, he's a fundraiser. He's a salesman. He's with a group of Muslims who are saying that they want to donate big money to NPR. And so he tells them what they want to hear. He says the Tea Party is filled with racists. Well, I think that's an arguable comment, but there is some proof. And depending on your perspective, it may be proof enough. He prefaced most of his comments by saying they were just his personal opinion. That was edited out by James O'Keefe. And this time, O'Keefe didn't say that he wore a pimp outfit when he didn't. But he did set the trap and spring it on Ron Schiller, who then quickly resigned. And Vivian Schiller, who, as you know, is not related to Ron Schiller, then was asked to resign by the board of directors of National Public Radio. And while I used to like Candid Camera, I thought Alan Funt was a cool guy who pulled off a lot of interesting stunts over the years. The Democrats are clueless. The Acorn takedown, as we have reported on this program in some detail, was done with the collusion of Democrats. They never investigated Acorn. They never tried to find out if it was true that these heavily edited, selectively edited videos represented how business was conducted at Acorn. They even rejected the explanations of Acorn officials who said, well, I could tell these people were up to no good, and I was trying to get information so I could turn them into the police. And at least one Acorn official, in fact, did that. But when the Democrats went along with defunding Acorn because they didn't really want to fight the Republicans over this, they sent a clear message, we can be rolled. So we had the case of the Department of Agriculture employee in Georgia, whose speech was selectively edited to make her look like a racist, a black racist. The Obama White House initially went along with that and then, realizing their mistake, tried to backpedal. And so this really seals the fate of NPR, in my view. They will not get a dime of federal dollars going forward. The cuts proposed by Republicans in the House to completely defund NPR, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and PBS, will likely go through. And given that NPR only gets about 1% of its money from the government, the member stations of NPR get about 10% from the government, I think, as Ron Schiller was quoted as saying in this heavily edited video, long term, it's probably in NPR's best interest not to take federal money. Then they won't be a punching bag for right-wing Republicans. But it's sad to see, once again, the Democrats have enabled a vicious and unethical, illegal attack. And they probably will just allow it to happen and write it off. I find that very sad. And likewise, the assault on Planned Parenthood is something that is very carefully orchestrated and is not a significant budget issue. And by linking Planned Parenthood to abortion, Republicans are feeding their base. And this is so misguided. It's not only illegal and it's unconstitutional because of the Supreme Court ruling that permits legal abortion in this country. But by commingling their messages over abortion and contraception, the Republicans are dealing us a setback that we will pay for years. With a new generation of teen pregnancies, teenage mothers, unwanted children, those who aren't cared for, and as we're cutting the social safety net, we're creating a world that Charles Dickens would not recognize. Yes, we're going to criminalize poverty and then put more people into poverty through economic policies and through this kind of biblical-based social engineering. It's really sad, tragic. And again, where are the Democrats? Can I offer you something a little brighter? Illinois has abolished the death penalty. Governor Pat Quinn signed legislation that eliminates the death penalty as an option and closes death row. Illinois becomes the 16th state in the nation without a death penalty. And you would imagine that it's the only one, because pro-death penalty forces in this country make it seem like it's the norm, that it's the way things should be, that it's what the Bible said. And the death penalty is costly. It does not provide certainty because of the lengthy appeals that the defendants are entitled to. And fundamentally, I think it's morally wrong. Thanks, Illinois. Illinois is also the only state I know of that responded to its budget crisis by raising taxes. Thanks, Illinois. You set an example on two levels there. Republicans in Washington have decided to spend untold amounts of millions of dollars. We can't project how much it will cost. But again, to feed the conservative base of the Republican Party, the Bible thumpers, John Boehner has authorized outside counsel to be hired by the House of Representatives on an open-ended blank check basis to defend the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, because they say that marriage can only be between one man and one woman. And this is another case where the Republicans who say that it's all about jobs, it's all about reducing deficits that they created, their agenda is very clear. They're using the economic crisis that they engineered to overturn decades of progressive progress in this country. These are really troubling times that we're experiencing, friends. And finally, as we speak today, I haven't seen any coverage, but Congressman Peter King of New York has opened his hearings on Muslim extremism in the United States. And I'll defer detailed comments on that until I hear or see coverage of these hearings. But I would just like to ask you, if Congressman King would be as comfortable investigating extremism in Christian religions, investigating fundamentalists and end of times believers who think that those factors give them license to kill people, to allow people to die, to foment wars, because it all leads to the greater glory of God and Judgment Day? Or how about Congressman King investigating the Catholic Church for its continuing, ongoing, present-day obstruction of justice in its failure to expose, investigate, prosecute the wayward priests who have continued to molest children? I don't think Congressman King has an appetite for that. But to pick on Muslims and to basically set up a McCarthy-like atmosphere aimed at a specific religious group is so damaging, so misguided. And, of course, in all of this, will Congressman King ever consider the question? The question, does America's foreign policy, do the wars we initiated in Iraq, Afghanistan, the use of predator drones over Pakistan and Yemen, do any of these efforts cause people to take up arms against us, to plot against the United States, to conspire to hurt Americans, even innocent civilians? Will that question be considered before Congressman King's hearings? I don't think so. That's my news and comment for today. Now, here's Will Durst with a commentary on madness in Madtown. Take it away, Will.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here to talk about the crazed leader besieged in his own capital, defying reality and obstinately holding on to power while attacking his own people. And, of course, I'm talking about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. The locals call Madison Madtown, and never has it lived up to its reputation as in the past month. Following a November sweep of both houses of the legislature, Walker, the Badger Ranger, decided the major cause of a state's deficit was the dastardly public unions, and in his so-called budget repair bill sought an end to their collective bargaining and placed obstacles in the way of their continued accreditation. The very week after he rammed through huge corporate tax cuts for the state, which is a lot like paying for your quarterly luncheon by garnishing the wages of the waiters. Now, in a closed-door session, Walker has run an end-around Democratic Senate refugees, passing the bill through a tricky parliamentary procedure, a move that runs the risk of offending ordinary Wisconsinites like a New York cheddar winning the blue medal at the state fair, and which may be more illegal than heroin in a holding cell. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. This Republican war on workers being waged all over the country. 11 states have pending legislation to strip unions of various rights. In Indiana, Democratic politicians joined their Wisconsin compatriots seeking political asylum in Illinois. Poor Illinois. Like, they don't have enough politicians doing nothing. But if you think this means the issue is over, you've obviously been spending too much time toasting the sunset while eating watercress sandwiches on the bridge of your yacht. As is their way, the GOP might once again have overreached and awakened a sleeping giant. As a matter of fact, I'll be most surprised if the AFL-CIO doesn't give Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker its Organizer of the Year award. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
On Wisconsin, you fight badgers. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.